A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was asked to sign a multi-million-dollar contract on behalf of a principal. Just a clerical task, not his usual role. And what struck him was that the contract itself wasn't any more complex than the ones he routinely handles for his own consulting work. Same process, same overhead, wildly different dollar figure. His question is basically, what stops consultants from charging what they're actually worth, and why the admin architecture of contracting makes a strong case for having a few large clients rather than many small ones? There's a lot to dig into here.
The thing that jumps out at me immediately is the invisible ceiling. Most consultants don't have a pricing problem, they have a self-concept problem. They've internalized an hourly rate that feels comfortable, and comfortable is almost always below market.
Comfortable is the enemy of solvent.
It really is. I was reading a piece from the Freelancers Union a while back, and they found something like 60% of independent consultants undercharge relative to their market value, not because they don't know the numbers, but because they can't bring themselves to say the number out loud.
The number feels like a confession. You're admitting what you think you're worth, and if the client doesn't flinch, you've undersold yourself. If they do flinch, you've overplayed your hand. It's lose-lose in your own head.
The psychology here is fascinating because it's asymmetric. The client is thinking about value delivered, budget allocated, problem solved. The consultant is thinking about whether they deserve it. Those are completely different conversations happening in the same room.
The consultant is having an internal existential crisis, while the client is just trying to get a thing done.
And here's the part that connects directly to what the prompt describes. The administrative overhead of contracting doesn't scale with the deal size. Whether you're signing a $5,000 engagement or a $5 million one, you're doing the same dance. Reviewing terms, checking liability clauses, making sure the scope is tight, filing the signed copy, setting up the billing relationship. It's fixed cost overhead.
Which means every small client is proportionally more expensive to maintain than a large one. The paperwork eats a bigger slice.
If you spend, say, 4 hours on contract management and onboarding per client, that's 4 hours whether the contract is worth $10,000 or $100,000. At $10,000, that's a significant percentage of your effective rate just evaporating into admin. At $100,000, it's a rounding error.
The small client model is actually a high overhead business, dressed up as diversification.
That's exactly what it is. And diversification sounds prudent. It sounds like risk management, but in practice, it's often risk multiplication disguised as prudence. You've got more relationships to manage, more invoices to chase, more scope creep to police, more renewal conversations to have. Each one is a potential point of failure.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure I follow the analogy, but I'm going to trust it.
You think you're doing something sensible. You're providing a home. You're diversifying your emotional portfolio. But now you've got a creature in your house that doesn't respect boundaries and will absolutely claw you if you make a wrong move. And you've got to feed it.
You've got to feed it. And the feeding is the ongoing relationship maintenance that doesn't show up on the invoice. The check-in calls, the hand-holding, the quick question emails that are never quick.
If we accept that the admin is fixed cost and the small client model is secretly expensive, the question becomes, why do so many consultants default to it?
I think there are a few things happening. One is the visibility problem. When you're starting out, small clients are easier to find. They're everywhere. Friends of friends, local businesses, people who need a website or some consulting hours. Large clients feel impenetrable. They have procurement departments and formal RFPs and legal teams.
The fortress mentality. The gatekeepers look more intimidating from outside than they actually are once you're through.
But the second thing, and I think this is the deeper insight from the prompt, is that the contract itself is the great equalizer. When you're holding a document that's worth millions, and you realize it's structurally identical to the one you use for your own five-figure projects, something clicks. The artifice of scale dissolves.
The Empress contract has no unusual clauses.
It's the same indemnification language, the same limitation of liability, the same payment terms, the same governing law section. The zeros change, but the legal architecture doesn't. And once you've seen that firsthand, you can't unsee it.
The threshold between a $50,000 consultant and a $500,000 consultant is incompetence. It's the willingness to stand in the same room with the same paperwork and not self-discount before the conversation starts.
That's where the psychology gets really interesting. There's a concept in behavioral economics called anchoring, where the first number mentioned sets the frame for everything that follows. Consultants often anchor against themselves. They think about what they made last year, what their peers charge, what feels reasonable. The client is anchoring against the value of the problem being solved.
If the problem is a $2 million problem, a $100,000 solution is a bargain. But the consultant doesn't always know the size of the problem because they're too busy thinking about their own rate.
This is why I've always believed that the best pricing conversation is actually a discovery conversation. You're not selling hours, you're selling an outcome. And the outcome has a value independent of how long it takes you to deliver it.
The classic plumber paradox. You're not paying for the 5 minutes it took to fix the pipe. You're paying for the 20 years of knowing where to hit it.
The plumber who charges $50 for the house call and $5,000 for knowing where to hit the pipe is the one who's cracked the code. Most consultants are still charging for the house call.
Let's talk about the multi-client versus few-client architecture. What does the research actually say about the optimal number?
There's no magic number, but the pattern that emerges from firms that have scaled successfully is concentration. The Pareto principle shows up everywhere, 80% of revenue from 20% of clients. And in consulting specifically, the most profitable independents tend to have 3 to 5 core relationships, not 20.
3 to 5. That's specific enough to be useful.
It's enough to diversify risk without fragmenting attention. If you lose one client, it hurts, but it's not catastrophic. If you have 20 small clients and lose 3, you're probably fine on revenue, but you've still got 17 relationships to manage. The overhead doesn't decrease proportionally.
The overhead is sticky.
And the other thing that doesn't get talked about enough is the cognitive cost of context switching. Every client has a different set of problems, different personalities, different communication styles, different expectations. Switching between them isn't free. Your brain carries residue from one engagement into the next.
The small client portfolio isn't just administratively expensive, it's cognitively expensive. You're paying in attention.
Attention is the one truly non-renewable resource. You can always make more money, you can't make more attention. Once it's fragmented across 15 different client contexts, the quality of thinking degrades.
Which brings us back to the contract moment that sparked all of this. Standing there with a multi-million dollar document, realizing it's the same paperwork. What actually changes at that scale?
Almost nothing in the paperwork. What changes is everything around it. The stakes are higher, the scrutiny is higher, the relationships are more complex, the decision-making involves more stakeholders. But the contract itself, the piece of paper, is fundamentally the same instrument.
If the instrument doesn't change, the barrier was never about the instrument. It was about the musician's willingness to play in a bigger hall.
That's beautifully put. And I think that's the core insight here. The admin architecture is scale invariant. The contract is scale invariant. What varies is the consultant's internal calibration of what they're allowed to ask for.
Allowed by whom?
There's no licensing board for consulting fees, no regulatory body that caps what you can charge. The ceiling is entirely self-imposed.
The practical question becomes, how does a consultant recalibrate? What's the mechanism for breaking through that self-imposed ceiling?
I think there are a few concrete steps. One is to deliberately expose yourself to larger scale transactions, even if you're not the principal. The prompt describes someone who signed a big contract as a clerical task, and that accidental exposure rewired their sense of what's normal. You can seek that out intentionally.
Proximity to scale is a form of exposure therapy.
Sit in on negotiations where the numbers are bigger than yours. Review contracts for deals outside your weight class. Offer to help a larger firm with their paperwork just to see what the documents look like. The goal is to normalize the zeros.
Desensitization therapy for pricing anxiety.
The first time you see a $1 million invoice, it's shocking. The 10th time, it's Tuesday.
The first time I saw a leaf that cost more than my apartment, I had a moment. Now I just think, well, it's a very nice leaf.
I'm going to assume that's a hypothetical leaf.
It's a metaphor, Herman.
The second thing is to restructure how you think about your own pricing. Stop calculating from costs and start calculating from value. If you're saving a client $500,000 a year, charging $50,000 is a 10-to-1 return on investment. That's an easy yes for any rational buyer.
That requires knowing the value you're creating, which means you have to ask questions about their business that feel uncomfortably personal when you're used to just billing hours.
That's the third thing. Get comfortable with the discovery process. Ask about revenue impact, cost savings, risk reduction. Quantify the problem before you propose the solution. The number you charge should be a function of what you're solving, not what you think you're worth as a person.
Separating self-worth from market value is the unspoken project underneath all of this.
It really is. And it's why so much consulting advice misses the mark. It focuses on negotiation tactics or contract language or marketing funnels, but the bottleneck is usually psychological. The consultant who can't say a big number out loud without flinching will find ways to sabotage every other part of the process.
The flinch is the tell. If you flinch at your own rate, why would the client not flinch?
Clients pick up on that instantly. It's almost subconscious. If you present a fee with hesitation, with apology, with a qualifying preamble about how you know it's a lot, but let me explain why, you've already lost. The fee should land like a fact, not a question.
The confident declarative. This is what it costs.
Then stop talking. That's the hardest part. Consultants love to fill the silence after they name a price with justifications and discounts and caveats. The silence is where the deal happens.
The silence is also where the consultant's internal monologue is screaming.
Let it scream, on the inside, while you maintain eye contact and wait.
We've established that the admin doesn't scale with deal size, that the psychological barrier is the real bottleneck, and that exposure to larger numbers normalizes them. What about the flip side? Are there actual risks to the few large clients model that aren't just fear talking?
Concentration risk is real. If you have three clients and one represents 60% of your revenue, losing that client is an existential event. So the few large clients model requires genuine relationship depth, not just contractual lock-in.
Depth meaning what, specifically?
Multiple touch points within the organization. If your entire relationship depends on one champion and that champion leaves, you're vulnerable. You need to be embedded enough that your value is recognized across the client's leadership, not just by the person who hired you.
You're not diversifying across clients. You're diversifying within clients.
That's exactly the reframe. Instead of 10 shallow relationships, 3 deep ones with multiple stakeholders each. If one stakeholder leaves, the relationship survives. If one client leaves, you've still got 2 more, and the depth of those relationships gives you time to replace the third.
Depth also means you're harder to replace. The consultant who knows the org chart, the politics, the history, the unwritten rules, that's not something a competitor can replicate with a lower rate.
The switching cost goes up the more embedded you are. And that's not about lock-in in a predatory sense. It's about genuine accumulated value. You know things about how the organization works that no one who just walked in the door could possibly know.
The institutional knowledge moat.
It's a real competitive advantage. But it only works if you're actually delivering value, not just coasting on familiarity. The moment you're seen as a comfortable fixture rather than a value driver, the depth becomes a liability. They keep you around because it's easier than replacing you, but they stop advocating for you internally.
The houseplant phase of consulting.
I'm going to use that. The houseplant phase. You're there, you're pleasant, nobody objects to your presence, but nobody would notice if you were gone either.
The goal is to be load-bearing, not decorative.
And load-bearing consultants charge differently because they're not selling time, they're selling structural integrity. If you remove them, things fall down.
Which brings us back to the contract. The paperwork that sparked this whole reflection. Is there something about the physical act of signing that matters here?
I think there is. The prompt mentions physically signing it, making sure it's retained, provided to the client. There's a ritual quality to the contract process that forces you to confront the reality of the commitment. It's not abstract. Your signature is on it.
The signature as reality anchor. You can't pretend it didn't happen.
I wonder if part of the pricing problem is that so much consulting work is informal. A handshake, an email, a verbal agreement. The contract forces clarity. It says, this is what we're doing, this is what it costs, these are the terms. There's no ambiguity to hide behind.
The contract isn't just legal protection, it's psychological scaffolding. It holds the consultant accountable to their own pricing.
It holds the client accountable to paying it. The formality works both ways. A verbal agreement can be conveniently forgotten or reinterpreted. A signed contract with clear payment terms removes the ambiguity.
Which means the admin overhead isn't just overhead. It's the infrastructure of seriousness.
That's a really important point. Consultants who resist the admin, who treat contracts as an annoying formality rather than a core part of the engagement, are signaling something about how they view their own work. If you can't be bothered to get the paperwork right, why should the client believe you'll get the deliverables right?
The care you take in the contract signals the care you'll take in the work.
The inverse is also true. A consultant who presents a crisp, well-structured contract with clear scope, clear payment terms, clear liability provisions, is already demonstrating professional competence before any work has been done.
The contract as portfolio piece.
And that's something most consultants never think about. They see the contract as a necessary evil, a hurdle to clear before the real work begins. But the client's first substantive interaction with you as a professional is often through that document. What does it say about you?
If it's a mess, you're a mess.
Or, at least, that's the reasonable inference. The client doesn't know you yet. The contract is the first data point.
Let's talk about the transition. A consultant has been doing the small client portfolio thing for years. They've internalized that model. How do they actually move toward fewer larger clients without blowing up their income in the short term?
The practical answer is, you don't do it overnight. You start by identifying which of your existing clients have the potential to grow into larger engagements, and you invest disproportionately in those relationships, while still serving the others, but with the understanding that the smaller ones are not the future.
Triage with a directional bias.
And as you free up capacity, either by completing engagements or by deliberately not renewing smaller ones, you redirect that time into business development aimed at larger targets. The key is not to quit all your small clients at once and hope for the best. That's how you end up with a very stressful quarter.
The bridge strategy. Keep the lights on while you build the thing you actually want.
The bridge strategy requires something that a lot of consultants resist, which is saying no to new small clients even when they show up. The temptation is always to take the work because it's there, because it's certain, because turning down money feels irresponsible.
Every yes to a small client is a no to the time you could have spent pursuing a large one.
Opportunity cost is the invisible line item on every consulting income statement, and it's the line item that most consultants never calculate. They see the revenue they earned, not the revenue they didn't earn because they were too busy with low-leverage work.
The ghost budget.
The ghost budget is often larger than the actual budget. The deals you didn't pursue, the relationships you didn't build, the rate increases you didn't ask for because you were comfortable enough with the volume you had.
Comfortable enough is the enemy again.
It keeps showing up. Comfort is the friction that prevents motion, and motion toward larger clients requires discomfort. It requires sending proposals with numbers that make your stomach tighten. It requires walking into rooms where you feel out of your depth. It requires the possibility of rejection at a scale that actually stings.
The psychological work isn't just about normalizing bigger numbers. It's about building a tolerance for bigger rejections.
Bigger rejections hurt more. There's no way around it. Losing a $50,000 deal stings more than losing a $5,000 deal. But the flip side is that winning one changes your trajectory in a way that 10 small wins never could.
Asymmetric upside requires asymmetric emotional fortitude.
Here's where the contract moment comes full circle. When you've held a multi-million dollar document in your hands, when you've seen that it's just paper with the same clauses you already understand, the asymmetry starts to feel less intimidating. The mystery dissolves. What's left is just the work of asking for what the work is worth.
The demystification of scale. It's not magic. It's not a different species of transaction. It's just more zeros attached to the same legal framework.
Once you internalize that, the only remaining question is whether you have the nerve to act on it. Which is not a business question, it's a personal one.
The business strategy is straightforward. Fewer clients, deeper relationships, value-based pricing, deliberate admin infrastructure. The execution is where it gets personal.
Execution is where most consulting advice falls apart because it treats the consultant as a rational economic actor making optimal decisions based on complete information. But consultants are humans with rent to pay and imposter syndrome and a deeply ingrained sense of what they're allowed to charge.
The inner accountant who won't stop whispering.
The inner accountant needs to be gently escorted from the premises. Not fired, because you still need to track expenses and file taxes, but removed from the pricing conversation entirely. The inner accountant is great at arithmetic and terrible at value.
Who should be in the pricing conversation?
The inner strategist. The part of you that understands the client's business, the value of the outcome, the cost of the problem remaining unsolved. The part that can look at a situation and say, this is a $2 million problem, solving it is worth $300,000, and I can solve it in 4 months. That's the pricing math, not what you made last year plus 10%.
The inner strategist is also the part that's willing to walk away if the numbers don't work. The inner accountant is terrified of walking away because walking away means zero.
That's the paradox. The willingness to walk away is what gives you pricing power. If the client knows you need the deal, you've already lost the negotiation. If you know you'll be fine either way, the dynamic shifts entirely.
Scarcity mindset versus abundance mindset, but with a contract and a signature line.
The contract makes it real. That's the thing I keep coming back to. The prompt describes a moment of accidental clarity, standing there with a document worth millions, realizing it's the same document you signed 100 times. That moment is available to any consultant who's willing to look at their own contracts and ask, what's actually different here besides the number?
The answer, most of the time, is nothing. Nothing is different. The difference is entirely in your head.
Which is both liberating and terrifying. Liberating because it means the barrier is movable. Terrifying because it means you're the one who put it there.
Self-constructed cage. Self-held key.
Now we're in philosophy territory, which I love, but I want to pull us back to something concrete. Let's talk about what a consultant actually does tomorrow morning if they want to start moving in this direction.
I'm here for it.
First thing, audit your current client list. Calculate the effective hourly rate for each client after accounting for admin, communication overhead, and context switching. You'll probably find that some of your smallest clients are actually your least profitable on an effective rate basis, even if the headline number looks fine.
The profitability illusion. Revenue is not income.
Revenue is absolutely not income, and the gap between them is where the admin lives. Second thing, identify which clients have growth potential and schedule a conversation about expanding the engagement. Not a rate increase conversation, an expanded value conversation. What else could you solve for them?
The upsell framed as genuine problem solving rather than greed.
If it's not genuine problem solving, don't do it. Clients can smell a revenue grab. But if you genuinely see additional problems you can solve and you can articulate the value of solving them, that's not an upsell. That's good consulting.
Good consulting is just noticing things the client hasn't noticed yet and offering to fix them.
That's the entire job in one sentence. Third thing, start building relationships with decision makers at organizations that are larger than your current client base. Not selling, just connecting. Understanding their problems. Being useful in conversation.
Brett, the long game. No immediate payoff, but the pipeline fills eventually.
Consulting pipelines are measured in months, sometimes years. The work you do today to build relationships might not convert until next year. But if you don't do it, next year arrives and you're still having the same pricing conversations with the same small clients.
Time passes either way. Might as well pass it in the direction you want to go.
Fourth thing, and this is the one most people skip, fix your contract infrastructure now before you need it. Have a template that's been reviewed by a lawyer. Have a clear scope of work format. Have standard payment terms. Have a system for storing and tracking signed documents. Build the admin architecture for the business you want, not the business you have.
Dress for the job you want, but for paperwork.
If your contract infrastructure looks amateur, you'll struggle to convince a large client to trust you with a significant engagement. The infrastructure signals readiness.
Readiness signals competence, which justifies the rate.
It's a virtuous cycle. Good infrastructure enables confident pricing. Confident pricing attracts better clients. Better clients justify better infrastructure. The opposite is also true. Bad infrastructure undermines confidence. Low confidence produces apologetic pricing. Apologetic pricing attracts clients who nickel and dime you, and those clients don't justify investing in better infrastructure.
The doom loop of undercharging.
Breaking out of that loop requires a deliberate intervention. You have to act like the consultant you want to become before you feel like that consultant. The feelings follow the actions, not the other way around.
Fake it till you make it, but with a legally reviewed template.
I'd frame it differently. Act as if you belong in the room until you do, and the contract is your ticket into the room. If your paperwork looks like it belongs at a larger table, you're halfway there.
The prompt's core insight, that the admin architecture doesn't scale with deal size, is really an invitation. If the overhead is fixed, the only variable is your willingness to ask for a number that makes the math work.
The math works better with fewer, larger clients. Not just because the overhead is proportionally lower, but because the depth of relationship enables value-based pricing in a way that transactional small client work rarely does.
The depth enables the pricing. The pricing justifies the depth. The admin stays constant. The only thing that has to change is what you believe you're allowed to ask for.
That belief changes through exposure, through holding the multi-million-dollar contract and realizing it's just paper, through sitting in rooms where the numbers are bigger and noticing that the conversation is the same, through accumulating enough evidence that your internal calibration adjusts.
If you're a consultant listening to this, and you've been stuck at a certain level, the question isn't what new skill do you need to learn. The question is, what room do you need to get into? What contract do you need to see? What number do you need to normalize?
The second question is, what small client are you holding on to that's keeping you from pursuing the large one? Because the math is clear. The admin is fixed. The overhead is fixed. The only thing that scales is the number on the contract, and that number is limited primarily by your willingness to write it down and slide it across the table.
Then stop talking.
The silence is where it happens.
This has been a thoroughly practical exploration of a deeply psychological problem, which is honestly where most business problems live.
The spreadsheets are never the issue. The spreadsheets are fine. It's the person reading the spreadsheet who needs the work.
The spreadsheet is mirror.
Now we're back in philosophy.
We never really left.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, a team of German arachnologists working in Patagonia seriously advanced the theory that certain orb weaver spiders could spin silk filaments with tensile properties that varied by lunar phase, based on field measurements that were later attributed to faulty hygrometers and wishful thinking. The theory was taught in European textile engineering programs for nearly a decade before being quietly abandoned.
Faulty hygrometers and wishful thinking is basically the subtitle of half the scientific papers of the 1930s.
The moon controls the silk. Of course it does. To wrap this up, the question we've been circling is really about what changes when you realize the contract doesn't change. And the answer is, you do, or you can. The admin is fixed. The paperwork is the same. The only variable is what you believe you're worth and whether you can say it without flinching. That's not a business strategy. It's a personal project. But it's the project that determines whether you stay small or build something that actually scales.
Fewer clients, deeper relationships, value-based pricing, and the willingness to sit in the silence after you name your number. The contract will take care of itself.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at My Weird Prompts.
If you got something out of this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.